Hello and welcome to another episode of Boundless Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Professor Massimo Pigliucci has a PhD in evolutionary biology from the University of Connecticut and a PhD in philosophy from the University of Tennessee. Currently, he is a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. His research interests include the philosophy of science, the relationship between science and philosophy, the nature of pseudoscience, and the practical philosophy of Stoicism. In the area of public outreach, Professor Pigliucci has published in national and international outlets, such as the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal, among others. At last count, Professor Pigliucci has published 180 technical papers in science and philosophy. He is also the author or editor of 14 books, including the bestseller, How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life. Other titles include Nonsense on Stilts, How to Tell Science from Bunk, and A Field Guide to a Happy Life. Professor Massimo Pigliucci, what an honor to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's so awesome to get to talk to you. It was a few months ago, a few of my friends had kind of started talking about Stoicism, and you could tell that they were really, you know, kind of getting into it. And I remember one of them said, you know, he was kind of talking about what Stoicism was all about. And I said, yeah, I get it. You know, I kind of understand the philosophy. It's a lot like Taoism. It's a lot like Buddhism. And I learned pretty quickly that it's absolutely not like any of those things. And there was a whole amazing world to discover in this world of Stoicism. What an amazing teaching this is.
It is an amazing world. Now, you're absolutely right that it is different from Buddhism and Taoism, but it's also true that there are a number of similarities between Stoicism and other philosophies, including, in fact, some of the Eastern philosophies. But yeah, Stoicism is its own thing and needs to be so understood in its own terms. It's a old Greek-Roman philosophy. It started out about 24 centuries ago in ancient Athens, and then it spread to become the most, you know, the dominant philosophy in the Roman Empire. And surprisingly, it has seen a resurgence over the last, couple of decades, even though it, in a sense, it has always been present in the history of Western philosophy and even religion, because, for instance, a lot of Christian writers have been influenced by Stoic sources. But it is kind of surprising that all of a sudden, 20 years ago, it started emerging into people's consciousness. And now it's becoming a very popular thing, which I think it's good. I don't have a problem with that, but I'm still surprised by the sudden success.
Yeah, definitely. Were you at all surprised that any of the teachings even survived? I know Socrates, a lot of his stuff wasn't even written down. Marcus Aurelius has Meditations, but that was never even intended to be printed.
That's right. In fact, the scholars estimate that close to 99% of the Stoic writings are lost.
Wow.
So we lost a lot. And nevertheless, we do have, as you say, Marcus Aurelius' Meditations, which was not meant for publication, but thanked Zeus or whoever, somebody actually transcribed it and saved it. And so now we have it. We have two books by a early second century Stoic named Epictetus, the Discourses and the Enchiridion, although he actually, like Socrates, he did not actually write anything down, but one of his students, Arrian of Nicomedia, fortunately did. And so we have Epictetus, we have Epictetus's voice still with us today. And then we have a number of books by Cicero and Seneca. Both Cicero and Seneca were Roman writers. Seneca was a Stoic, as well as the advisor to the Emperor Nero, and he wrote a number of books, many of which survive today, especially 124 letters that he wrote to his friend Lucilius, which are kind of an informal curriculum in Stoic philosophy. And Cicero, he was not a Stoic, but he was very sympathetic to Stoicism, and he wrote a lot about the Stoic philosophy. And so a lot of what we know about Stoic philosophy comes from Cicero. Unfortunately, we have almost nothing of the early Stoics. We have names. We know that the founder of Stoicism was a guy named Zeno of Citium, and we know a few things about him. We know that one of the major figures of early Stoicism was a logician named Chrysippus of Soli, but all of their books are lost, and we only have fragments that are reported by other sources.
Wow, that is boggling to think that 99% of all of it was lost, but how much richness we get with just the 1% that we have. That's incredible. I want to talk about some of the tenets of Stoicism, but before we do, I really would love to hear your story, how you came across it and you became interested in it, and I would love to hear how it helped you along your way.
Well, my personal story has to do with a midlife crisis, which is something that a lot of people go through. So it was nothing special, but you know, there was a time where when a number of things happened to me that I was not necessarily expecting. You know, a sudden divorce, for instance, my father dying of cancer. They happened in the span of a few months, and so those are the kind of things that, together with you know, turning 40 at the time, kind of threw me for a loop. And I said, oh, okay, that's interesting. Now, how am I going to deal with all this stuff that is suddenly happening? And as you naturally would, you would turn to whatever religion or philosophy you have been using up to that point as kind of a framework for life. Now, in my case, I grew up Catholic because I grew up in Rome in Italy. And so kind of by default, you're a Catholic. But I left the church when I was a teenager, so that was not an option. After I left the church, I turned to secular humanism, which is an interesting, I think, well thought out philosophy that has to do with using reason and evidence to solve your problems, that endorses concepts such as the universal human rights, and you know, it's focused on justice and so on and so forth. The problem is when I tried to use secular humanism to deal with my specific immediate crisis and not with general concepts such as human rights, I found it wanting. I thought, I don't see anything here that's going to be particularly useful. Now, at the time I was beginning to train as a philosopher. My first academic career was in biology, but I was training as a philosopher at the time. And so I figured, well, as a philosopher, you ought to be able to look up something that might be useful. I mean, there is a lot of philosophies of life, so why don't you start doing some research? And so I did. I studied a little bit of Buddhism first, which was interesting to me, but the language really didn't click with me, in part, of course, because I just didn't grow up with that tradition. But some of the concepts were a little bit alien, and so it's like, yeah, this is interesting, but doesn't click. I looked into a number of Western philosophies, including Aristotle and Epicurus, and those were not clicking either for one reason or another. And then what happened was that on Twitter, of all places, I saw this thing that said, help us celebrate Stoic Week. And I thought, the hell is Stoic Week? And why would people celebrate the Stoics? Because at the time, of course, I thought that Stoics were these people like Mr. Spock from Star Trek that walk around, you know, with stiff upper lip and suppressing emotions, which turned out not to be true. But then I remember, I said, wait a minute, the Stoics, that includes Marcus Aurelius, and I had read the Meditations in college and found it interesting. They also included Seneca, as I mentioned earlier. Well, when I was in high school, I translated Seneca from Latin, you know, as sort of part of my exercises. So wait a minute, those were interesting people. So let's take a look. And so that's how I started. And the very first Stoic that I studied and I read about was Epictetus, and he immediately clicked. When I started reading Epictetus, he came across to me as a no-nonsense kind of guy. He's very plain-spoken. You understand him even without any background in philosophy. He's addressing real issues. Of a variety of issues, from how to deal with minor annoyances when he has an episode in the discourses where he goes to the baths and he tells himself, you know, remember, you're going to the baths, and so what's going to happen is people are going to splash you, somebody's going to try to pick your pocket, you just deal with it because this is the nature of going to the baths. To the very important things. I mean, he talks about death and mortality and things like that. So it's an incredible range of topics. He speaks about these in a very plain and no-nonsense manner. And he has a charming sense of humor, which kind of borders on sarcasm. So I was hooked. And I started studying and then practicing Stoicism. And that made an immediate change, effect in my life. It helped me seeing things from a broader perspective, including death and loss and things like that. It helped me being less angry, less irritable, you know, working on improving myself as a human being as much as I can. And so it has made a major impact in my life ever since.
Wow, that's amazing. I don't think it's ironic at all that you landed on a philosophy that was from basically your backyard, but it also spans millennia. One of the things that is so surprising to me is how human and relatable these people are. Like you think, you know, 2,000, 2,500 years ago, what the hell do I have anything to do with a Roman? But it's very human. They deal with the same emotions, anger, jealousy, things break, people die. Like it's all so relatable. That's something that really surprised me.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting because often people ask me, you know, why would I want to study a philosophy that is, you know, more than 2 millennia old? You know, what do these people have to say to me? And I say, well, if you were studying a science that were 2000 years old, you know, let's say Aristotle, then you'd probably be wasting your time because Aristotle as a scientist is interesting only from an historical perspective. You know, modern science has made a lot of progress and you're not going to learn a lot of biology or physics by looking at the Stoics or Aristotle or the Epicureans. However, if we're talking about ethics and the ancients understood ethics as literally the study of how to live your life, then you're going to learn a lot because human life hasn't really changed that much. Yes, it's changed superficially, right? So technologically, like we're talking, you know, I'm talking to you over, you know, the internet and using a laptop computer. Obviously, Seneca would have been stunned by these kind of technological advances. But as you just pointed out, human nature and the problems that human beings deal with have not changed that much. In fact, one of my favorite passages in Seneca is in a letter that he wrote to his friend Lucilius, where he's complaining about all the noise that is coming from outside his apartment, from the streets below, and he cannot concentrate and he cannot write. And I say, yeah, that's right. I'm living in New York City. I got the same problem, right? It's the same issue. But of course, they also deal, as you were pointing out, with big things. You know, they wanted the same kind of things that we want. They wanted to be loved. They wanted friends. They wanted material comforts. They also dislike the same kind of things or trying to stay away from the same kind of things that we are trying to avoid, like disease and, you know, death and stuff like that. So we're really in the same boat. Now, we're reading the Stoics as well as other ancient philosophers, including, as I said, not just from the Western tradition, but from the Eastern as well and other traditions as well, because these are people that actually paid attention to what was happening. They had a lot of, you know, a good ability to observe and understand human nature. They were very good psychologists, if you will, way before psychology was invented as a discipline. And so that is why a lot of what they say still applies today. Mind you, not everything. You know, there are things, you know, for instance, in the case of the Stoics, you know, the Stoics on the one hand were way ahead of their time in terms of, for instance, how they thought about women. Because Seneca and Epictetus explicitly say that women have the same intellectual abilities as men, and therefore they ought to be able to study and practice philosophy in the same way. That's, you know, something that said 2,000 years ago was stunningly ahead of their time. But even so, they cannot help being a product of their own time and culture. And so when Seneca wants to make fun of somebody, he tells him not to be effeminate, right? Mm. Which today, you know, make us cringe. And it's like, okay, I need to update that kind of language, right? I don't need to use that language. But those are relatively minor things. You can tweak and update a little bit the Stoics from that perspective. But most of what they wrote still very much applies today.
I love that. You said that when you adopted this practice, that it really greatly improved your life. And I wonder if you have a personal story, just the first thing that comes to mind. It doesn't need to be major life shifting. It could be maybe something that happened today, or it could be a big event. Do you have a specific time where you're thinking of right now that Stoicism really practically helped you improve your own life?
Yeah, in a number of cases. And let me give you one example from this past year during the pandemic. But before I tell you about the example, because otherwise it wouldn't make a lot of sense, I need to introduce one of the basic Stoic concepts, and that's referred to as the dichotomy of control. The dichotomy of control is this notion that we find in Epictetus that some things are up to you, meaning that you can actually control them, and other things are not up to you. There's not much you can do about it. And that a good life is lived by focusing your attention where on the things you can control and the things that you can act on, and sort of developing an attitude of equanimity and acceptance toward the things that you cannot control. Now, this may sound familiar because it's pretty much the same concept that you find in the famous Serenity Prayer. The Serenity Prayer is a early 20th century Christian prayer that is often recited at the openings and meetings of 12-step organizations like Alcoholic Anonymous. And basically, the Serenity Prayer asks God to give us the wisdom to tell the difference between what you can change and what we cannot change, the courage to change what we can, and the serenity to accept what we cannot. Well, the reason it's very familiar and it's in the Christian variety is because the Christians got it from the Stoics. And the same concept is actually found in other cultures where it arose independently. For instance, it is found in 8th century Buddhism, among other places. Now, the economy of control has helped me in a number of instances, one of which happened during the pandemic last year. So at some point, fairly early on in the pandemic, we were here in Brooklyn with my wife, and we were not seeing other people. We were rarely going to the grocery store and all that sort of stuff. And so when we went getting some groceries, we would get large quantities of stuff in our refrigerator and freezer. And then one day, the refrigerator breaks down. Mm. Now, that's a problem for a variety of reasons, right? Because that means that now all of a sudden that you cannot actually, you have to go out more often, like on a daily basis. You cannot buy fresh produce or fruits unless you eat it immediately. So it would have been a significant hurdle.
Your gelato. So, your poor gelato would have melted all over
the place. That's right. My poor gelato would have completely gone. So now, normally, I would have been pissed off and upset and, invoked the gods because of, what the hell, the pandemic and all that sort of stuff. But instead, our thinking went immediately to the economy of control. And we say, okay, we cannot do anything about the fact that the refrigerator is broken. That's it. Also, we cannot do anything about the bigger picture. We cannot avoid being in a pandemic. This is not up to us. It's not something that we can control. What can we do? What is it that we actually can act on and try to ameliorate the situation? Well, the first thing was, let's call the building and see if we can have a new refrigerator delivered. And the answer was no. They wouldn't allow major deliveries, deliveries of major appliances because of the pandemic. So, okay, that's not good. Next, do you allow delivery of small appliances like a dorm refrigerator? And the answer was yes. All right, well, that's better than nothing. So we immediately got one of those things and we shifted accordingly our pattern of, going out and getting food to a smaller amount of fresh produce and fruits. No gelato, unfortunately, for a while because the small refrigerator did not have a freezer and, more canned things or dry foods and stuff like that. And that went on for several weeks, in fact, for a couple of months until the situation improved enough that our building allowed delivery of major appliances, at which point we got the new refrigerator and then the situation was done. Now, this is a rather minor episode. It's not, nothing was life-threatening, nothing was life-changing. But at the same time, it really helped the fact that because of my Stoic training, my mind immediately went to not toward the sort of regretting what was happening and getting pissed off at what was happening, but immediately to like, okay, what can I do? Where can I act? And the rest, let's just take it as it is because there's nothing I can do about it. So that really does not only make your life more efficient because you're actually taking charge of what you can take charge, but also you're not wasting a lot of emotional energy, regretting things that you don't control or being pissed off at things that you don't control. That's it. There's nothing you can do about it. So why the hell would you want to waste an iota of mental energy thinking about stuff that you cannot alter?
That is a wonderful example of the dichotomy of control. It's so interesting. It's like two sides of the same coin where it's equal parts absolutely horrifying, realizing how few things are actually in your control, and also extremely empowering, because then you realize, okay, there are things I can do. And I've noticed, kind of similar to what you just said, where it puts you in a calmer state of mind where you can start going through options and thinking about it without that emotional reactivity that I see with a lot of people and I see with myself in the past.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And in fact, you know, human beings have a psychological need for control over their situation. And in fact, a lot of, you know, psychologists will tell you that a lot of anxiety, depression, irritability, you know, anger management and anger issues, a lot of those things, not all of them, but a lot of these come from the fact that we don't feel we have enough control over certain situations. And the dichotomy of control teaches you that that's right, you don't. Guess what? You actually don't control a lot, and it's okay. It's okay, because this is a fact of life. You know, what is the point of complaining about a fact of life? It's unavoidable. And so instead of struggling for increasing your control over things that you really cannot, in fact, ultimately control, instead of getting stressed out about those things, you can accept that and then refocus on the things that you really do control, where you really do make a difference. And this applies to everything in life, by the way. It's not just to refrigerators and pandemics, right? Suppose that you are going for a job interview. Same thing. Most people tend to be focused on what the Stoics would say is the wrong side of you know, of the coin, that is on the outcome, right? Oh, I want the job. Will I get the job? And then you start stressing over whether you get the job or you won't get the job. Well, guess what? That is not up to you. That's up to whoever interviews you. And a lot of factors that enter into it, you don't control, like who else is competing for that job, for instance. You don't even know oftentimes who is competing. You don't know how good they are. You have no idea. And it's not under your control. So don't stress about it. What should you focus on? Well, the things that are actually under your control, which include putting together the best resume possible for the job, preparing for the job interview in the best way you can, even showing up on time for the job interview if it is in person or on Zoom, dressing appropriately, not going out drinking with your buddies the night before, because otherwise you're not going to get enough sleep and that's going to interfere with your performance during the interview. That sort of, all of those things are up to you. And so by focusing on those, you do two things. First of all, you reduce your stress, because now you feel like you're in control of things. And second, guess what? If you do all of those things, the chances are you're going to get the job. Your chances are definitely higher than they would be otherwise.
Yeah, that's such a great point. Some authors talk about the trichotomy of control, and you kind of disagree with that and keep us focused on the dichotomy of control. And I wonder if that's important to talk about, or why you feel so strongly about that.
Well, it's important to talk about it because when you start trying to change the dichotomy into trichotomy, you're essentially destroying a major concept in Stoicism in a way that it's not actually useful. Because, you know, look, if it were useful to move from a dichotomy to a trichotomy, well, fine, let's do it. Just because, you know, the ancient Stoics didn't think in terms of a trichotomy, that doesn't mean, you know, they were not oracles, they were not right on everything. So, in fact, Seneca at one point says very clearly to his friend Lucilius, it's like, you know, the ones that have come before us are not our masters, they're just our teachers. And if we discover new ways and better ways of doing things, we should do it. So there's nothing in Stoicism that sort of forbids improving on the ancients. I mean, these are not sacred texts, right? This is not the Bible. I'm perfectly free to disagree with Seneca or Epictetus or Marcus Aurelius and do things differently if I think it works better. However, in the case of the trichotomy of control, I don't think it works better. So the notion of the trichotomy of control is actually kind of intuitive, even though I think it's incorrect. And the intuition is this, like, wait a minute, you're telling me that there are some things that I control and other things that I don't control. But what about all the things that are in between, that I don't completely control, but I influence, right? For instance, let's go back to our example of the job interview. Well, maybe, certainly the outcome is not entirely under my control, but I certainly can influence it, because if I prepare for the interview, the chances that are going to get the job are actually higher, right? So shouldn't we be thinking about a trichotomy, things that I control, things that I don't control, and then a bunch of stuff in between? And the answer is no, because all the stuff in between, all the things that fall under the category of you influence themselves can be broken down into these two components, what you control and what you don't control. I just gave you an example, right? So by preparing myself, preparing for the job interview, I do influence the outcome. I make it more likely that I will get the job. But it still remains true that that influence is only the result of the fact that of the parts that I control, of the fact that I'm preparing myself. That's up to me. My influence does not extend to making decisions, making the actual hiring decision. That decision is still completely outside of my control. So everything that we influence is actually the result of these two components. And it is useful to think of the two components instead of this continuum, because when you start thinking about a continuum and a gradation of things, then you lose kind of the sense of where it is that you can act the way it is that you cannot act. If you stick to the dichotomy, it's much more clear. Preparation is up to me. Intention is up to me. Judgment is up to me. Those are all up to me. Outcomes are not.
Yeah, gotcha.
That's pretty much it.
Interesting. I think it makes it more simple. It keeps it really easy to think about the things you can and can't versus, like you said, that continuum in the middle. So if we take away all the things that we can't control, what do we have left? Like what are the things that at the end of the day we really can't control and we should really spend most of our time thinking about?
So Epictetus says that there are four things that fall under our control, although I will argue in a minute that it really boils down to just one. But he mentions four. He says that we control our positive values, that is what it is that we value, what we think that it's valuable. Our disvalues, that is what we think it's not important, right? And he calls these desires and aversions. But basically what he's talking about is, you know, the things you value and the things that you don't value, the thing that you disvalue, that they don't think are important. So those are two things. Then we control our decisions to act or not to act in any particular circumstance, right? We don't control the outcomes of our actions, but we do control whether to act or not to act, right? Mm-hmm. So it is up to me, let's say, to decide whether I want to be vaccinated or not. And by the way, the answer is yes. Of course, I got
that. Thank you.
Right, but it is up to me, right? That's my decision. It's because it is something that I have to do. I have to go somewhere. I have to make an appointment, etc. So your actions, meaning the decisions to act or not to act, and then he says your overall judgments, how you think about things. For instance, do I think that the COVID virus is dangerous or not? Well, that decision is up to me. Now, of course, there is an objective answer out there. It is dangerous. But I may or may not disagree with that answer, right? And so Epictetus says, that's your judgment. And you should try, of course, to arrive at the best possible judgments because your life literally may depend on it, right? If you arrive at a bad judgment about a situation, you may actually make a mistake. If you arrive at, let me give you the example again about the pandemic. So let's say, what is it that I value and I disvalue? Well, I value my health and my life, right? And I disvalue the notion of ending up in the ICU or at the cemetery, right? So those two things are up to me. Those are my values and disvalues, according to Epictetus. My judgments about the situations are up to me. And my judgment is that the virus is in fact dangerous, and therefore I should do whatever it is that makes it less likely that I'm going to be infected. And my decisions to act are up to me. And those decisions include maintaining social distancing, wearing a mask in public, getting a vaccine when available, and sanitizing my hands, right? So those are all the things that you control. That's it, as far as Epictetus is concerned. You don't control anything else. Whether you're actually going to get sick or not, it's not up to you, because viruses are, you know, pretty nasty kind of things. You could do everything right and still end up, in the ICU. Likely you are not, because the more right things you do, the less likely it is that the outcome is going to be adverse. But you need to be prepared for the possibility that even if you do everything right, it still are not, you know, things are still not going to work for you. So he says that those four things are up to us. Now, I would suggest, however, that those four things really boil down to one and only one thing, which Epictetus, in fact, also realizes, because he uses one word over and over in both the discourses and the manual, and that's prohairesis. Prohairesis is a Greek word that means volition or judgment. It's our faculty of judgment. It's our faculty of decision making. Because if you think about it, you know, I did mention four things, one of which is explicitly was judgment, right? But the other three are also kinds of judgments, right? My decisions to act or not to act are the result of my judgments. If I decide to wear a mask, that's a result of a judgment that wearing a mask is, in fact, a good thing, given the circumstances. My values and my disvalues are also the result of judgments. Because if I judge, for instance, if I value not ending in an ICU, that's because I judge that it's a very unpleasant thing to end up intubated into an ICU, right? So in reality, it all comes down to one thing and one thing only. The only thing we are in charge of, ultimately, is our own judgments, which is why especially Epictetus's type of training in Stoicism really aims at one thing only, at improving your judgment. Making you a better person, in this case, means a person that arrives at better and better, sounder and sounder judgments about pretty much anything in life.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, when you put it like that, that doesn't leave a lot of room for a whole lot of other things. One of the things that drew me to Stoicism that's different from what I can tell from like skepticism is even with the things you can't control, you still can have preferences, right? It's not like I have to go sell all my stuff and I have to, you know, be absolute minimalist and all the things that I have. Like I can want a better car than a worse car. I can want a nice house. I can want my house not to burn down. It's just realizing that you can want whatever things that you like and whatever things you care about in life. It's just not anchoring your whole entire belief system around those things. Is that right?
That is correct. So the Stoics refer to this as the with a phrase that sounds, you know, oxymoronic, like preferred indifference, right? So it is a preferred indifference for me to have money in my bank account. It is also a preferred indifference to have a nice apartment here in Brooklyn. It is a preferred indifference to have a job and so on and so forth. Now, what the hell does that mean? What is it? How is it possible that something is both preferred and indifferent? Well, the answer there is that those two words actually refer to different aspects of your system of values. Things like the ones that we mentioned, which the Stoics class as externals. So anything that is not your judgment is an external. So your health, your wealth, your reputation, your career, your possessions, all of those are called externals. They're referred to as externals. And you can have preferences. In fact, it's perfectly natural human to have preferences about those externals. However, those externals are at the same time indifferent to your character. That is, they don't make you a better person or a worse person per se. Just because you have a lot of money in the bank account, that doesn't make you a good person. And vice versa, by the way. Just because you're poor, that doesn't make you a good person either. If you have a job or you don't have a job, that doesn't make you a good person or a bad person. It just makes you somebody that has a job or doesn't have a job. If you have a nice car, that doesn't make you a good person or a bad person for that matter. So all of these things, all these externals are essentially morally neutral. They are indifferent in that sense. They're morally neutral, right? And so you can prefer them, other things being equal, so long as you don't compromise your integrity, you don't compromise your character in order to acquire them. There's one bit in Epictetus where he says, you know, you guys, my friends, are telling me that I should, you know, make some money so that I can help friends and even maybe my city. And he says, I have no problem with that so long as you teach me how to make money without exploiting other people. Because if the only way for me to make money is to exploit other people, or if when once that I make that money, I'm going to use that money in order to oppress people, then that's not good. That affects my moral character. That makes me a bad person. So it's not the external that makes me good or bad. It's how I acquire and use the external that makes me good or bad.
I love how you mentioned earlier too about, you know, becoming better at making certain judgments in your life. And one of the examples you give in your book is the gelato, going back to your beloved gelato. It's like, would it be good for me to eat this gelato? Like, hell yeah, it would. It's delicious. Of course it would be. But then wait a second, maybe this isn't so good for me in the long term. Maybe I'll gain a few pounds because of this. Maybe I'll have to start a workout program because of this. And so can you comment a little bit about, you know, not only your interactions with other people, but also your interactions with like your future self.
That's right. So that's a very important aspect, because Stoicism is a very other regarding philosophy. It does teach us to treat other people well, with fairness, with justice. But it is also about your own, how you conduct your own life. And so in the case of the gelato, for instance, yeah, of course, it's very pleasurable when you have it right there in the moment, right? And it's not like I never have gelato. Occasionally, I allow myself to have the gelato. But the trick there is occasionally, meaning using temperance. Temperance, by the way, it's one of the four cardinal virtues recognized by the Stoics, right? So that means doing things in the right measure. So it's not like you have to deprive yourself of certain things necessarily, but you have to think. Again, you have to use your judgment, right? And say, all right, hold on a second. This is very delicious and it's very pleasant. And the pleasure will last for 5 minutes, right? But am I going to regret this? Right? Either in terms of health or in terms of efforts that I have to make later on to sort of balance things out. Or maybe simply because, it turns out that I saw the gelato at, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And I'm about to join my wife for dinner and I don't want my appetite to be spoiled. And I want to have a nice time with my wife or my friends, so on and so forth. So the notion is always use your judgment. That doesn't mean you're not going to have certain things. It doesn't mean you have to live a life of privation and, and be like a monk in the desert. That's not the point. The point is everything you do should come with a judgment, should be approved by your prohairesis, by your faculty of judgment, and say, okay, is this a good idea? Is this a good thing? And as you say, this applies not only to how you treat other people, but also how you treat your future self. Because, I do value, for instance, living to a ripe old age in good health. And, that's an outcome. So it's not up to me, right? But certainly I can influence that outcome. How do I influence that outcome? By acting where it is on things that are in fact under my control, such as my diet, such as seeing a doctor on a regular basis, following the doctor's advice, and so on and so forth. Right. And the more I do those things, which are the result of good judgment, the more likely it is that I will live to a ripe old age. But of course, there is no guarantee. And that means that I have to be ready mentally to say, I'm hoping that I'm going to go, up to, my late 70s or 80s, but it may not happen. And I need to be okay with that, because that's not up to me.
The grand piano could still fall 20 stories.
Yeah, exactly. Anything could happen, right? You could go into the streets and be hit by a car and that's it. End of the story.
Well, this is a perfect segue to one of my favorite components of Stoicism, which is negative visualization. I had a really tough time with this one in the beginning. I thought this was a little bit weird, but boy, what a helpful tool to be able to assess the value of things in your life. Can you talk a little about the negative visualization?
The negative visualization is a type of Stoic exercise, basically a type of Stoic meditation. And a lot of modern Stoics, following the advice of modern psychotherapists, actually do it as a visualization exercise. That is, the idea is to imagine a situation that you may experience actually in the near future, and start with the worst possible case scenario. It's like, so for instance, again, going back to my earlier example of a job interview, well, the worst possible scenario there is you're not going to get the job. Well, okay. So the notion here is that before you get to the actual situation unfolding, you take some time to think about it and to visualize in your mind the scenario and say, okay, fine, I'm not going to get a job. Then the question you ask yourself is, so what? How am I going to react to this situation? Is that really the end of the world? Is this something that I cannot cope with? Right. And so you replay these scenarios several times in your mind. And every time you ask yourself, okay, but how do I deal with this kind of situation? How do I prepare myself mentally for this kind of situation? Seneca says that a prepared mind is one that actually is never caught off guard and deals better with the adversities of life, precisely because you do expect them. Right? People often don't deal well with adversity because they don't expect it. That you often hear the phrases like, you know, oh, I would have never thought it could happen to me. Well, why? What do you think is so special about you? You're just a human being like everybody else. And so if things, if something like not getting a job or being diagnosed with a terminal disease or anything like that, it has happened to other people. It may happen to you. Mm-hmm. And you need to be prepared. You can't just count on the fact that, you know, it's not going to happen to you because you are not that special. You know, you're just a human being. Now, as I said, many modern Stoics do this as a visualization exercise. So you close your eyes, you know, take a moment, you know, quiet moment in your apartment or your house, close your eyes and sort of play basically a movie of the situation in your head. Now, I have to say, I am not that good at that sort of stuff. I don't do well with visualization exercises. And so I do it more like Marcus Aurelius was doing it, by writing down stuff. So I imagine my scenario by actually writing it down. It's like you write a short story or you write a letter to a friend, imagining the scenario and then discussing how you should be prepared for it and how you should be dealing with it. And it works very, very well. You're right that initially this is a kind of a weird thing because the natural reaction of people is like, why the hell would I want to imagine, you know, spend my time imagining bad things happening to me? Isn't life bad enough already anyway? Why would I want to imagine bad things happening to me? But the notion there is not that you imagine them so that you dwell on them at an emotional level. The notion is you imagine them so that you can think about them analytically and prepare yourself to deal with whatever situation it is in the best way you can. Mm.
I love the way you recommend how to address that too, because you ask us to, you know, come up with a few scenarios that are not preferred. You would not like them. They could be a wide range of things. Then give them like a number 10, a 1 to 10 score on how difficult that would be. So a 1 might be like you stub your toe on your bed. A 10 is like your house burns down and your wife and my 2 dogs and cat all die. Like that's a 10. That's really uncomfortable. Yep. I'm not going to start at the 10. I might find something that's like a 4 or 5 uncomfortable that like, yeah, I really like this pint glass, but if it breaks, like I'm not going to lose my shit over it, you know?
That's right. And in fact, as you know, Epictetus actually has this idea of going at it gradually. He says, you know, when you contemplate bad things happening to you, start with the simple stuff. Start with one of your favorite mugs that breaks and tell yourself, well, it is in the nature of mugs to break, right? It's okay. Yeah. And then you work your way up to more and more difficult situations, including the death of your loved ones or your own death. Because, sure, you know, at some point, Seneca says the your own mortality, your own death is actually the most difficult test of your character. You know, how are you going to deal with it when you get to that point?
Sure. Well, and the other thing that happens, like by the nature of the thing, is now I'm going to look at that pint glass and I'm going to appreciate it so much more now that I have it.
Exactly.
I'm going to see my wife and appreciate her more because I have her now. We get to go on a walk today. It's so much more, you get so much more fulfillment and gratitude from that simple practice. It's great.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Epictetus uses a metaphor that I actually adopted as the title of my blog, Figs in Winter. And he uses the metaphor of figs in the winter. He says, if you wish for figs in winter, you're a fool, because of course the winter does not, you know, yield figs. Fig trees don't flower in the winter. But you should enjoy the figs in the summer when it's a proper season to enjoy them, because they're going to be there. And you are a fool. You're equally a fool if you don't enjoy them when they're there. So the same goes for everything from the small things in life to the big ones. Yes, your loved ones are eventually going to go. You know, I've lost at this point both of my parents, for instance, you know, years ago, and years apart from each other. This is natural. This is a normal thing. It's going to happen. And what's important is, how did you spend your time when they were alive? How are you, and more importantly, the people that are alive and important to you now, your partner, your friends, your children, whatever it is, right? That you should, you know that either they are going to be gone or you are going to be gone one of these days. There's just no way around it. So eventually, you know, as they say, all good things must come to an end. The issue, therefore, is don't focus on the end, because that's outside of your control. What is in your control, on the other hand, is to enjoy what it is that you have right now, to redouble your efforts, to spend time with your children, your partner, your friends, and so on and so forth, because that's what it's important. That's what's and it is, you know, under our control. Making that decision is under your control.
Yeah, I love that. That's very well explained. You wrote the best-selling book, How to Be a Stoic, and it was one that I encountered a few months ago, and I really, really loved it. How was that writing process for you, and how were you able to take some of these concepts and make them so simple and easy to understand in today's world?
That is a good question. You know, every book is different. I mean, at this point, I think I wrote like 15 books, and it's a different process every time. I have to say, How to Be a Stoic was by far the easiest book that I've ever written. And that's because I had such an enthusiasm for the subject matter, and I had developed over, you know, years a sufficiently intimate knowledge and understanding of the subject matter, that when I decided to write the book, I went on sabbatical and I moved from New York to Rome, because I figured, hey, if you want to write about the Stoics, you might as well be where the Stoics lived. Besides, I'm from Rome, so that was a perfect excuse to visit my family there, right? And so I spent several months there, and I have to say, it just was so easy. Just I sat down in front of my computer, and the damn thing just came out one chapter at a time, very, very quickly. It doesn't always work that way, unfortunately, I would say. some books are, you know, more difficult to write than others, more challenging than others. But How to Be a Stoic really was a labor of love, so to speak, and therefore not much of a labor, really.
Wow.
It was a lot of fun.
That's amazing. I mean, the love really shines through. It was so easy to understand. You had great stories. You know, you involved yourself in a lot of those stories, which is great. I'm also sitting next to my handbook, A Handbook for New Stoics, How to Thrive in a World Out of Control. You decided to create something a little bit more practical, and this is a beautiful book, by the way, which I love, and I hate putting pen to the pages. I hate it, but I do it. And I've done it every week. I'm on week 11 now. Why did you decide to come up with a handbook that was a little bit more practical?
Well, so this was an idea that came up with my friend Greg Lopez, who is the co-author of that book. And we figured that, you know, there is a lot of talk in modern Stoicism of the importance of Stoic practice. And rightly so, because Stoicism is a practical philosophy. I would say it's one part theory and nine part practice. But even so, you don't see a lot about how to actually practice. There are some books that contain some exercises, some hints at how to actually practice Stoicism. But there was no single place where people could go and have a large sample of Stoic practices that were both directly taken from the ancient sources. Each one of the 52 exercises in the book is researched that way, but they're also updated with modern science. I mean, if you bother to look at the footnotes or the endnotes there, you will see that a lot of the exercises there are actually modified in a way that takes into account research in cognitive science, you know, personal psychology and things like that. And so we just thought, look, this thing is nothing like this is around. There's no resource like this. And so it is a little bit of a unique book. And it was fun to write because Greg, for one thing, has a background in cognitive behavioral therapy, which, as you probably know, is a very successful evidence-based type of psychotherapy, which was originally influenced by Stoicism. It came out it started out in the 1960s, and the early originators of CBT were directly influenced by Stoic writings. Yeah, so it's interesting to combine, you know, essentially the best of modern psychotherapy with the best of ancient philosophy, which is what the book does. And it is very practical. You're right. There are spaces in the book where you can write. Oh, by the way, if you don't want to write in the book, the publisher actually makes available from their website a number of PDF files that you can download.
Oh, great.
And write in those instead.
Nice. Next year.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, I found that was interesting to write the book because, of course, we went ourselves through those exercises, right? We tested basically each exercise as we were putting them together and writing the book. And I also found that a lot of people have benefited from it. Now, there are 52 exercises. And if you want, of course, you can go through every single one for an entire year. Basically, it's 52 weeks. But you don't have to. I mean, it's not like we're asking people necessarily to make that kind of big commitment. If you look in the introduction, for instance, there is a cheat sheet there that tells you to focus on a smaller number of exercises to get started. And then if those work for you, then you can expand and still, you know, pick and choose from the rest. But of course, if you feel like you're already committed to Stoicism, then by all means, you should go through all 52 of them, you know, week by week. It definitely makes for an interesting year of self-analysis and self-growth.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I'm only 11 weeks in. My wife's a week behind me, so she's on 10. But watching it work in my own life, and like you said earlier, the magic of writing. Like, I've had exercises where I'm writing things down, and I wasn't, like, consciously thinking those thoughts. It's like the pen is writing itself, and I'm almost, like, shocked to see some of the things that are put on paper. And then you read it and contemplate it and go, wow, like, I suffer a bit from imposter syndrome, or, you know, I haven't fully addressed this in my past. It's just, it's made a huge difference in our lives, and it's so practical and fun to do. It's fun to talk about. It's worked really great between us, and our communication between the two of us. Was it difficult for you to come up with all 52 of those different exercises? Because they are so unique. There is not one week that's like another week. It's completely different. Right. It changes all the time. Very engaging.
Thank you. No, it was not really very difficult because, in fact, if anything, we had a trouble narrowing it down. The original list was much longer than 52. And then also in collaboration with, in consultation with our editor at The Experiment, which is the publisher of the book, we said, okay, let's come up with this thing of, you know, one per week for a year. That's probably more than enough. It's more than most people would do anyway. So if anything, we had the opposite problem, that we had to sort of cut it down a little bit. Wow. There is more. The ancient sources, even though they are, as we were saying in the beginning of our conversation, they're only a small percentage of what the Stoics wrote. They are so rich that it's amazing. It's unbelievable.
Wow, that's incredible. Can you tell us a little bit about your latest book, A Field Guide for a Happy Life?
Sure. Yeah, with pleasure. So the Field Guide is a different kind of project. As I said, my favorite Stoic, the Stoic that influenced me the most, has been Epictetus. And Epictetus, one of the two books that are attributed to Epictetus, although, as I said before, he actually did not write it, one of his students did, is the Handbook, also known as the Enchiridion. And the Handbook is a short book. It's made of 53 sections. And each section, it's basically, often it's just a paragraph or two, sometimes a little longer. And they address different aspects of your life, and they give you very direct advice on what to do and how to behave in life. Now, the problem is that Epictetus is not a household name. Not a lot of people have heard of Epictetus, which is it's a new thing because, as it turns out, Epictetus was very famous throughout the ancient times. His school in Nicopolis in northwestern Greece was the most sought after school of the second century, or the early part of the second century. It was very well known during the Middle Ages and Renaissance, and that's because the Handbook was actually used by Christian monks as a practice, for spiritual exercises. It was read by Renaissance authors such as Michel de Montaigne, for instance. So it was very famous also during the Renaissance. And in fact, it was famous until the 19th century. Most of the major American founding fathers, George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, all of them had a copy of the Enchiridion in their library. And so Epictetus was actually a household name. Then something happened during the 20th century, and it kind of went into an eclipse. And I think that's too bad. I think that Epictetus should be read by more people. And so the first goal with the Field Guide for a Happy Life was to bring Epictetus' philosophy to the attention of a broader public. And the way I tried to do that was to essentially rewrite the Enchiridion. So the book, as you will notice, the central part of the book has 53 sections. Each one of them mirrors one of the original sections in the Enchiridion. It is about the same topic. And in several cases, the substance of the entry is about the same as Epictetus. The language is updated, of course. The examples are updated to the 21st century, and the language is a little bit more approachable. However, there is also a number of entries in the field guide that, although they talk about the same topics that Epictetus was concerned with, the substance is in fact different. And that is my attempt to not only bring Epictetus back to the attention of modern audiences, but also to update Stoicism for the 21st century. Because frankly, nobody practices Christianity, let's say, or Buddhism today as people practice Christianity or Buddhism 2,000 years ago. It's just not the same. The basic ideas are the same, but a lot of the details are different. A lot of the interpretations are different. They are up to date modern life. And so the same should be for Stoicism in my mind. And so that's the twin goals of that book, of the Field Guide for a Happy Life, are number one, to bring Epictetus back to the attention of a general public because he deserves it, because he's one of the most influential philosophers really of all time in the Western tradition. And second, however, to take that occasion to also contribute something of my own to the development of Stoicism for the 21st century.
Well, it is very good. You make a lot of really interesting points, and it does sound much more updated and modern, and you will agree with certain things and disagree with certain things, which I really like. I listened to that book on Audible, and I think that would probably be a better one to have on paper. Is that true?
I think that's true, because it is meant to be read not necessarily cover to cover, or at least the first time you can read it cover to cover, but then it's meant to be a handbook. As in literally, something you have in your pocket or in your backpack, and you take it out from occasion, you open it at a random place and you read and you reflect on what it is that the book tells you. That's the way I use Epictetus' Enchiridion. I open it at random places and then say, let me think about this for a minute here. So that's the goal. So you're right. A electronic version or a paper version is probably better than an audiobook.
Yeah, great. But, I'm going to go order one right now. That's awesome. So you are nonstop. Anything you're working on for the future?
Yeah, I just finished a new book. It's literally been delivered to the editor of Basic Books just like a couple of weeks ago. And I wish I could tell you the title, but we haven't settled on a title. The current provisional title is The Philosopher and the Politician. And the basic idea of the book is an exploration of the relationship between philosophy and politics. And, should philosophy influence politics? Should ethics in particular influence politics? And what does that mean? And the reason it's called the Philosopher and the Politician is because the first half of the book is about this really interesting relationship between Socrates and his friend Alcibiades. Socrates, of course, as we know, is arguably the most famous philosopher in the Western tradition. Alcibiades was this flamboyant, incredibly smart, rich, and incredibly attractive man who made a huge impact for good and for ill, as it turned out, on Athenian history during the time of Socrates and during the Peloponnesian War. And so the book explores the relationship between these two as an example of the relationship between a philosopher who tends to think about how to do things properly and a politician who tends to think about how to do things expediently. And then from there, the book also explores other similar relationships between philosophy and politics. So I write about Marcus Aurelius, of course, who was literally a philosopher king. I write about Julian the Apostate, one of the late Roman emperors, who was also, as it turns out, a philosopher king. I write about Cato the Younger, who was a Stoic senator and politician, and so how he dealt with these two realms of politics and philosophy. And then the second part of the book brings things forward in time. And so I talk about the obvious, probably next step, which is Machiavelli during the Renaissance. And his take, you know, he was a philosopher, but he was also a political scientist, as we would say today. So his take on realpolitik and how one should actually conduct the affairs of state. And then I come all the way to the 21st century with current theories of the relationship between ethics and philosophy and ethics and politics.
Well, that's pretty timely, man. I don't think we have a lot of either philosophy or ethics and politics.
I know.
Thought that went out the window last year.
That's exactly. That's exactly why I wrote the book, because I figured, and you know, there is, I mean, it would have been all too easy for me to make a bunch of references to Trump and you know, things like that in the book, but you will see hopefully when it comes out that actually there are no references to contemporary affairs on purpose, because that will date the book. That would say, you know, and then besides, people, once you start naming names, people start taking sides, and that's not the point. The point is, you the reader will be able to apply, you'll figure it out, you'll be able to apply the ideas of the book to whoever is in charge at the moment and whatever it is that they're doing. It doesn't matter what it is, Trump or Biden, or sure, whether it is we're talking about Afghanistan or Syria. It's all the same in that broad category. I'm not saying that all those situations are the same or all those people are the same, sure, but these are all examples of how politics and philosophy actually do interact, whether people realize it or not.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm definitely looking forward to that. Man, this has been such an amazing opportunity to get to talk with you. I just want to know if there's one simple tip you would like to leave, you know, for the average listener, like myself, like not a philosopher, you know, didn't study this in school. What one simple tip would you like to tell, you know, the average schmo on the street, like how they can use some of this stuff to make their lives better?
Oh, I think that I cannot do anything any better than, again, going back to Epictetus and right at the beginning of the Enchiridion, where he says, just remember throughout your life, some things are up to you and other things are not up to you. And a good life is made of focusing on the first and developing an attitude of acceptance and serenity toward the rest.
I love that. That's fantastic. Professor Pigliucci, where would you like people to go to find your work?
People can find me at figsinwinter.blog, which is not just a blog, but it's basically a repository of everything that I do. So all of my books and articles and podcasts and videos and all that sort of stuff, it's all linked from figsinwinter.blog.
That's great. Yeah, that's a tremendous resource. I mean, we had to greatly abbreviate your introduction. We didn't even talk about podcasting, all this other stuff you do. And there's so many resources on that website that are just absolutely fantastic. Professor Pigliucci, thank you again so much. Really sincerely, like, this is something that has really helped improve my personal life and the way I see the world and act in it. And it's cool that I was introduced to these concepts in a way that was simple to understand and easy to apply to see those benefits. So we're so grateful for you and for your work and for sharing your gifts with the rest of us. We really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's been an honor. And this has been another episode of Boundless Body Radio.